I'm going to read from this passage in John chapter 5, and it's a wonderful story in our series of encounters with Jesus, of how Jesus breaks through into the life of ordinary people. And this story, I think, is one of the most intriguing of all of these stories in the Gospel of John. In some ways, it's a strange story about how Jesus encounters a man looking for a little magic in his life, and he gets something completely unexpected. So let's read this. I'll read the story just to kind of get us into the groove here. So it says this. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now, there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I am trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." At once, the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you're well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well. So this is really a remarkable story with all kinds of interesting things in it. And it's been a lot of fun, actually, to reflect on this story over the last number of weeks to try to get a sense of what it is that the Lord is saying to us in this story. It's a story about a man who's paralyzed. Here he is. He's stuck. He's immobile. He's frozen in place. And as I've been thinking about this story and trying to think about some stories to tell, you know, because Dan and others who preach here are such good storytellers, I asked Bronwyn, my wife, "You know, what's a good story you have of a time when you were stuck and unable to move?" And she told me about a time when, as a small child, she put out her tongue to taste the ice on a frozen metal fence. And you know what happens. As all children in Canada eventually find out, if you do that, it sticks. Growing up in South Africa, I have no experience of frozen metal posts as a child, but I actually have a version of the same story that happened to me, but this time it was in, you know, the freezer in your fridge. You open the door and you go, "Oh my word, that looks like ice cream." And you get stuck there. And then you have to wait for something to happen. And usually it just involves losing a bit of skin on the end of your tongue. Ow! Hate that. Anyway, there's another story that I have from my childhood in South Africa about getting stuck that came to mind as I was thinking about all of this. My brother and I used to go swimming in a lake that was just down the hill from where we lived. Lake is a very grand name for this kind of like muddy pool of water. But you could swim in it, and we used to go on a raft out to the middle, and we'd dive off, and we'd try to swim to the bottom and, you know, grab some of the mud and then come up to the top again. The first time I did that, though, I found out that when you're right out of breath and you're just about to reach the bottom, you have to give yourself a really good push off the bottom to get back up. And that's when your feet sink into the mud and you're stuck with 10 feet of water above your head. That's the feeling of being stuck in the mud with water over your head. So have that in your mind as we're thinking about this today. What does it mean to be stuck, and how can we become unstuck from this place of immobility? It's not a very nice feeling. Now, in order to set the scene of our story today, the story about this man who's stuck and unable to move, I want us to think a little bit about the setting in which the story takes place, because it's a very interesting setting. And the actual location of the story gives us a lot of clues as to the meaning of what's going on. So, we're told right there in the story that these events take place in Jerusalem by the sheep gate. It says, by the sheep gate there is a pool called Bethesda, and it has five porticos or five colonnades. Now, this pool is very interesting in its own right. For many years, archaeologists thought that this pool scene was an invention of John, that there was no such place. Archaeologists had looked, and they had never been able to find this actual location. No one had ever discovered the pool, and so people thought, well, it's probably just a symbolic pool. And, you know, we know that John likes to use symbolism. He likes to talk about light and dark, and he talks about things like, you know, water as being, you know, it's got symbolic meaning in John, and bread's got symbolic meaning. So this must be symbolic too, because it talks about five porticos. What's the symbolism of five? Well, you have to start making stuff up. And they thought, well, maybe it refers to the five books of Moses, the over-reliance on, you know, Moses. Well, that was fine until people discovered, about 100 years ago, actually discovered this pool. And really, it was took a longer time after that to actually identify this pool as the pool in the story. The key thing is the reference to the five porticos, and people had been looking for some kind of pentagon, you know, kind of a shape with five sides to it. Porticos are covered kind of rows of columns that would be around the pool. So they figured it was a pentagon of some kind. But then it turns out that actually they were looking for the wrong thing altogether. And they realized that this pool was in fact the one. And that's a reconstruction. Actually, you can go to Jerusalem and you can go to this model of Jerusalem and you can see this structure that's there. And you might not immediately think that that's got five colonnades. But if you think of it as a rectangle, there's a colonnade, see the columns around the outside, one on each side, one, two, three, four. And then there's a colonnade across the middle. That's the fifth colonnade. So that's an unusual structure. And there you've got a pool. In fact, it's two pools. It's like there's one pool slightly higher than the other. It's like it's a bathing complex, right, in the city of Jerusalem. And people realize this is it. And it's in just the right place. It's right where John said it would be, outside where the sheep gate would be, on a stream that comes in from the higher land that's just outside of the city of Jerusalem. So there it is. It's not symbolic. It's a literal pool. It actually existed. It's not a pentagon, but it does have five colonnades. Now, something else that we learn from the story here is that it was, for whatever reason, a destination for the sick and the disabled. John says that the blind and the lame and the paralyzed would lie there for long periods of time. Now, that raises a question for us as well. What was it about this location that drew people to it? Why were people going to this particular place for healing? What was it about this location? So, there's a number of possibilities. The most likely identity of this place, what is it, is it's probably a public mikveh. It's like, oh yes, that's helpful. That's what I thought too. It's a mikveh. Clarifies things. Well, a mikveh is a part of the landscape of Jerusalem in this period of time. It's a public ritual pool where you would go when you were preparing for the temple. If you wanted to go to the temple, you had to undergo a kind of ritual washing. So it's not exactly a bath, but you had to kind of go into the water and then you would be cleansed ritually. And then the temple is nearby. Then you could go to the temple after that in a state of ritual purity. So it's a requirement of Jewish life that you had to bathe before going to the temple. Rich people would have these kinds of baths in their own house, And there's lots of examples that archaeologists have found of small little mikvahs. But this is a public mikvah for ordinary people to go to so that they can get ready to go into the temple. And all of that reminds us that Jerusalem is a holy city. It's a city that's completely focused on the life and activity that's happening in the temple. And there was this expectation that people would maintain higher than normal levels of kind of ritual purity. They would always be thinking about, well, I've got to go to the temple, and this afternoon I better pop in at the mikveh to get myself in a right state of purity. So religious observance and being ritually kind of appropriate is on people's mind a great deal. So that's at least part of the solution. This is probably this kind of a ritual bath where people go to prepare for going to the temple. But having said that, though, that doesn't completely solve our question of why were all these sick people there? Because mikvahs aren't places necessarily where you go to get healed. They're places where you go to get prepared for the temple. In fact, it's not entirely clear that all of these sick people at the mikveh would have even been allowed into a temple, because the temples were usually restricted to people who were sort of able-bodied and healthy and didn't have deformities or defects of any kind. So there's still a bit of a mystery around why there's so many sick people in this particular location. So that brings us to some other thoughts about why this place was the location of all of these sick people. And we've got a clue in verse 7. Here we have a conversation that Jesus has with this man. When Jesus asks him if he wants to get well, the man replies, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I am making my way, someone else gets down in front of me." Now, that's not the way people talked about mikvahs. It's not the kind of thing where you had to wait for a special moment, you know, the water turns and then rush everybody and then only one person gets clean or something like that. But apparently there's some kind of local tradition connected to this pool that says there are special curative properties attached to the water, and that that curative sort of feature only works when the water is being churned up or has become turbulent. Now, people have wondered, why did the water become turbulent? Perhaps there was a spring that was feeding this pool with water. Maybe they were it was mineral waters, and people felt, hey, I feel really well when I go to this pool. And then the tradition spreads that this is a good place to go. Or more likely, we saw that the two pools are at different levels from each other. Probably the people who are running the pool, every now and then they have to allow water to go into the lower pool. So they open a sluice gate or something, and the water flows from the higher one to the lower one, and it gets all turbulent, and whoosh, it's like this is a good time to jump into the water, and you might get healed in the process. So there's some kind of dynamism to the pool. The water actually moves from time to time. And apparently some people got the idea that this was caused by some kind of divine agent. And so there's this strange verse in verse 4 that talks about an angel. It says, "An angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever stepped in the water first after the stirring of the water was made well from whatever disease that person had." Now, that's a strange verse, because you might notice that when I read the story before, I didn't read this bit. And that's because in most of our Bibles today, that verse isn't there anymore. But it is there in older versions. And that's because in the ancient manuscripts, some of the ancient manuscripts have this verse in it. And it's probably an example of how an ancient scribe who was writing the story long time ago wrote this verse in the margin to try to explain why the water was churning up, and thought it must be an angel of the Lord. And so they wrote it in the margin like a personal note. Note to self, wonder why the water is being churned up. It's the Lord. Then some later copyist came along, saw that, and thought, that's brilliant. That explains it. And then they copied that verse straight into the Bible of their copy. And then it became a part of some versions of the Bible. Okay, there's a little bit of textual criticism. This is what I do for a living. So that part of the story was not in the original Gospel of John. but it made it into some of the early manuscripts. But it just ties into the sense that people wondered and thought that there was some kind of cure attached to this pool. And all of that leads me to wonder if there was actually a shrine attached to the pool. Now, this god, this is a Greek god called Asclepius. Everybody should know about Asclepius. Asclepius was one of the most popular gods in the Greek and Roman world. Asclepius was the god of healing. And scattered all around the Mediterranean world, there were shrines. There were healing spas, places where people would go and spend time, many times overnight, many times by pools, and they would seek the help of this god called Asclepius. And so it's quite possible that this mikveh was actually functioning as an Asclepion. Everybody should remember that name. You say, what did you learn in church today? I learned the word Asclepion. An Asclepion is the shrine dedicated to Asclepius. And Asclepius has, of course, become very famous. He's always depicted with a staff with a snake wrapped around it. And that's why even today when you go to, if you look at your medic alert bracelet or you go to the emergency, you'll often see this symbol of a staff with a snake wrapped around it. It's the sign of Asclepius, the god of healing. And the Hippocratic Oath, which doctors all say that they give the Hippocratic Oath to say that they won't treat anybody badly. It's made to Asclepius. Doesn't that give you great comfort to know that our doctors have all, devoted themselves to never breaking faith with Asclepius? Anyway, so archaeologists have found evidence that there was an Asclepian cult in the region, that in this area of Jerusalem. They've actually found artifacts with snakes on them. So it's quite possible that this place that we're dealing with here is not just a straightforward Jewish site. It's actually a place where there's also the worship of Asclepius taking place. And so people have come from all around in order to hope, against hope, perhaps, maybe this time, this god will break through and help me. Now, you might be surprised to find that there's this kind of influence in a place like Jerusalem. We thought, well, this is a Jewish city, it's a holy city, why the heck are they worshiping Asclepius? But the fact of the matter is, for 200 years before the time of Jesus, there has been a great deal of Roman and Greek influence in the city. There's Greek theaters, there's Greek baths, there's sports complexes, there's all kinds of sort of imported influences in the city. And this particular site, as we saw in one of the previous pictures, is right next to the Roman fortress called Antonia, where Roman soldiers were garrisoned. And so it's quite possible that many of the people going to this site were in fact Roman soldiers and other kinds of Gentiles who were used to hanging out at a shrine of Asclepius. So that tells us a little bit about this sick man as well. He's the kind of person who probably knows it's a bit dodgy for me to be here, kind of hoping against hope, well, maybe God will help me. I'd like to go to the temple, but if that doesn't work out, Asclepius is a good backup. And you can see it's a kind of a scene, a very human scene of people hoping for something, kind of a poignant scene of people there desperate for some kind of a breakthrough in their situation. So that leads me to think about the man himself. This person who becomes the center of attention in the story. Now, we're not at all clear what's wrong with the poor guy, but we're told that he's been sick for 38 years. That's a really long time. Think about what you were doing 38 years ago. Some of you haven't got a memory of 38 years ago. That's okay. Before you were born. Imagine being paralyzed for that long, stuck. In fact, that story about me going to the bottom of the lake was about 38 years ago, purely coincidentally. So instead of having had a life filled with activity, a life filled with accomplishments, with traveling, with being a part of making things happen, this man has had a life of being stationary, of being immobile, of being dependent on others. He can't even get himself into the water when the water is stirred, no matter how hopeless even that would be if he managed it. And in the ancient world, even more so than today, disability had a stigma attached to it. People were often blamed for their own sicknesses. They were often blamed for their disabilities. They were seen as a curse of a god, or maybe they had done something to deserve it, or their parents. There was a sense of doom attached to a person who was suffering in this way. And people would try to avoid these kinds of folk. They didn't want somehow that person's suffering to rub off on them. And so there's a kind of mixture of revulsion and of fear that was always attached to people who had diseases or disabilities, especially when they were of this catastrophic kind that lasted a lifetime. There was always the fear that this person was a bringer of bad luck. So we don't know how this poor man has got into this situation. Perhaps he's had an accident as a child. Perhaps he suffered from a disease. Who knows? But it's a very sad case. And people like him often ended spending their lives begging. And there's examples of that in Acts chapter 3, for example. There's another lame person waiting outside the temple gate, and he's begging. And that's often the life of this kind of a person. In this case, perhaps it's an indication that he comes from a slightly well-to-do family, because someone has actually brought him to this pool, and perhaps they bring him there every day and take him away in the nighttime. It's a sad case of hoping against hope, nothing ever happening. And so it's into this scene then that Jesus quietly strides. This place of suffering and longing, this place of desperation and futile hopes. And it's just an amazing example again of Jesus' true nature shining through in grace and kindness. Notice that Jesus offers no critique or condemnation. There's no analysis of cause and effect. There's no sermon about who's to blame for what. Jesus doesn't say to himself, too bad for them. They're hoping for the wrong thing. He doesn't say, if they want something from Asclepion, let's see if Asclepius can do it for them. Jesus doesn't criticize them for their desperation. Rather, he simply goes up to this man and asks the simple question, do you want to be well? You would think that there would be some more complicated solution required. After such a long period of inactivity, the man's muscles would have been completely atrophied. There would be no strength in his body. He would be incapable of bearing his own weight. Even a few weeks of being bedridden would require any one of us significant physical therapy of some kind to get us going again. But none of that happens in the story. There's just the question, do you want to be well? And that's the key moment in this story. It's the moment when Jesus speaks into this hopeless situation and simply asks the man what he wants. Now, notice the dynamic of what happens here in this conversation. Instead of replying with a simple, yes, that would be great, we've already seen the man actually gives an evasive answer. He says, sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred. And while I'm making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me. So instead of a straightforward answer, the man offers a narrative of blame. I have no one to help me. He's blaming his family, perhaps, for not being there to help him. It's a narrative of resentment. Someone else always gets there ahead of me. All those other sick people, they have it much better than me. I'm just stuck. One of them always gets ahead of me. And so it's a narrative of missing out. It's a narrative of missing out. He's always just pipped at the post. He's like someone who's hoping to win the lottery and he's just almost got the right number, but then, that other one, that was the better number. He's come so close, perhaps, and now it's a narrative of the loss of hope. I'm sure we all know people like this. Perhaps we see this in ourselves as well. I can certainly think of myself in the story. How easy it is to just think of, ah, if only that had happened. If only that person hadn't got in the way. If only they had helped me a bit more when they had the chance. Now, here's the truly remarkable thing about this, what I find the most fascinating thing is what happens next. Was Jesus hears the man's answer and interprets it as yes. Do you want to get well? No one ever helps me. Okay then, I'll heal you. Jesus heals him anyway. Jesus sees right through the kind of the excuses. He sees right through the pain of the man's desperation. He doesn't say, look, you had your chance, mate. All you had to do was say yes, you blew it, I'm gone. Next, you over there, you know, you with the tumor, I'll help you instead. He doesn't. He understands that the man is trying to say yes. To me, it's a sign of such grace. You don't have to say the right words, because Jesus is not a magician. It's not like there's some spell. Just say the right word, open sesame, and poof, something will happen. Rub this, you know, magic lamp and the genie will pop out. Jesus confronts him with the real question, and the man is trying to answer out of his brokenness, out of his paralysis, out of all the narratives that have bound him in place. Jesus hears the yes in that. And so he says to him, get up and walk. And he does. It's an amazing thing. Jesus knows us. He knows our places of stuckness and paralysis. He sees who we really are. He knows the story of human suffering. And he hears the deeper answer. And so, this is the good news in the story, is that Jesus heals the paralyzed man despite his own inability to really respond properly to Jesus. And as Jesus healed him, he still heals us today. He still goes into offbeat places like the Asclepians of culture, looking for people who are stuck and stalled and paralyzed. He goes to all those places where people are looking for healing, where people are looking, hoping against hope, something good may come of this, maybe now I'll find a breakthrough. And so Jesus even comes to 10th Church here in Kitts. Jesus is with us today. And Jesus is still today asking us, each one of us, do you want to be well? Do you want to be well? And so we are asked to respond. And what will our response be? Will we have a narrative of loss? Will we say, well, you don't know all the things that have happened to me? Jesus is asking us today, do you want to be well? There's so many things that paralyze us. There's so many things that keep us frozen in place, stuck, stalled, immobile. We can so easily become paralyzed by fear, by anxiety, that constant low-level dread that can suck the life out of us because of our lives, just the nature of modern life. For me, this is probably the most paralyzing thing, I would say, for me, that constant sense of feeling like, something terrible is about to happen. I don't want to do psychoanalysis now, though. We can be paralyzed by regret. You know, you think about an opportunity that came, you made the wrong choice, or something happened, and you can just get stuck with that sense of that cloud of regret. Everything would be different now if I had taken that other path. We can be paralyzed by sorrow, deep sadnesses that come into our life, that break our hearts, that are genuine wounds in our soul. And while we need to acknowledge the reality of those things, of those deep sorrows and heartbreaks, they can also become places of profound paralysis. We can become paralyzed by anger and by hatred. So easy to have personal resentments against individuals, people who did things to us, people that sinned against us, that committed crimes, people who were abusive, people who abused us. And we can get caught up in the anger and the hatred of that and find that we're not able to move anymore. We're stuck. We're never on our feet. And we can be paralyzed by what the ancient church called acedia. Is another good word for the day. Acedia is a sense of just being kind of meh. You know, that's a deep spiritual problem. Not giving a rip. Just not caring. And it's a very endemic and established paralysis that all of us face in different times in our life. When you get to that place where you just realize, I just don't care anymore. And what's worse is that I don't care that I don't care. That's when you're really stuck. Now you can think of lots of other things as well, I'm sure. Ways in which we find ourselves stuck, paralyzed. And so I invite us all in this time just to think about, what is it that's holding me captive? One of the most important people in anyone's life is their father. I always tell my kids this, your father. He's the most important person in your life. My own father was a man who suffered from chronic paralysis. He wasn't physically paralyzed, but he was emotionally paralyzed. He had had a very difficult childhood. Dad, his mother died when he was 7 years old. She died of TB, and so he was raised in sort of really dodgy kind of multiple situations, foster homes, boarding schools, and so on. Left school when he was 14 or whatever it was, became a railway guy and eventually an electrician. And over the years, he became deeply angry. And the anger led to deep, endemic, overwhelming depression. And it led to other health issues as well. He was unable to move on. He was stuck in the narrative of how difficult his life had been. And every fact that he could tell you was true. Those things all happened. But of course, the misery of that kind of a story flows into the whole family. And so then the whole family lives in an environment of that kind of stuckness. And then one finds that these things start appearing in one's own life as well. So I find in myself, all of the things that bothered my dad bother me as well. Issues of anger, resentment, grievance, just because I inherited them all from that environment. You may have your own story of being stuck. And we all need to hear Jesus saying to us, do you want to be well? Jesus comes into this scene and asks us that question. And I can remember the time when I was an adolescent, a late teenager, when I confronted that question. And the question was, do you want Jesus in your life? And by the grace of God, I don't know how it really was, but somehow the answer turned out to be yes. And that started the rest of my life. And I came to Canada and met good people and have the life that I'm in today. Began to walk. And we've all got stories like that as well, where we can think of times when we said yes to Jesus and began to walk. Now, I don't actually know how much time I've used up here, Dan. I have no idea what time it is. Are we doing okay? I thought you said there was going to be a clock somewhere. He lied to me. I resent that. I cannot complete this talk. Now, there's a kind of second part to the story, because the religious leaders, who are also kind of there, they're always a part of the background of the story, and they kind of intrude into the story every now and then. How did they respond to what's happened? Are they delighted? This guy's been sick for 38 years. Here he is walking around. Do they rejoice at the alleviation of suffering? Do they? No. They're downright ticked. They're annoyed. Because there's nothing religious about what Jesus did. Jesus didn't enact any liturgy. He didn't sort of involve any kind of religious belief. He didn't say, "Do you believe in me?" There's no religion involved. And so the religious leaders are seriously annoyed. They hate the unorthodoxy of what Jesus has done. They hate the grace of it. They hate that the rules are not being followed. Their response, crazy, it seems completely bizarro, is to say, "Hey you, the law forbids you to carry your mat." They don't notice he's walking. For 38 years, he's been lying there. Now he's walking, and that's what they have to say to him. Now, the Sabbath is a day of rest, and they're upset that he's breaking the Sabbath. The Sabbath, of course, is a wonderful thing in itself. But this guy is not really up for resting right now. He's had nearly 2,000 Sabbaths of doing nothing. He's breaking this one. Okay, give him a break. It's hardly the worst thing that he's done in his life. So the authorities have got the technical details of the law right, but they're missing the point. The healed man's joy, this new energy that's coursing through his body, this new power of mobility, none of this means anything to them. But we see here this interesting point that the presence of God's life in this man causes him to break religious conventions. Notice that Sabbath observance is also an identity marker. It shows that you belong to this community. In the Old Testament, we find God telling the Israelites to keep the day holy. No one was allowed to work, from the top of society right down to the lowest level. It was a recognition that there are rhythms in human life. It's a very humane and beautiful requirement in the law. It's a recognition and a reminder that we're not slaves. In the ancient world, the only people who ever got a day off were the slave owners, the people who had money, the people who had wealth. Those are the only ones who ever had a chance for rest or leisure or relaxation. But the Jews had built right into the structure of their society this beautiful thing, this weekly day off for everybody. So, in effect, the Jews invented the weekend. That's where we get the idea of the weekend from. It's from the Old Testament. And so observance of Sabbath in the ancient world was so unique that anyone who observed it was immediately identifiable as a Jew. And so this was obviously a matter of pride, but it was also something that came to be a rule of community belonging. And the religious purists, like the Pharisees, took it upon themselves to police who was in and who was out of this community based on their religious observance. They turned something that in itself was beautiful and life-giving, they turned it into a burden and a test. Now, notice that being healed by Jesus did not make this man belong to conventional society or to the religious in-group. In fact, the opposite was the case. Sabbath observance would make him belong, but here he was using his newfound ability to carry his mat on the wrong day. So once again, this poor guy finds himself excluded, but for this time for a very different reason. For 38 years, he's been excluded because of his disability. Now he's excluded because he has responded to the words of Jesus. Pick up your mat and walk. And that is how it is with everyone who has been touched by Jesus. All of us who hear Jesus say, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk," are going to find ourselves on the wrong side of all kinds of conventional ways of thinking. We're going to find ourselves on the wrong side of religion, the wrong side of conventional society. And so that's another part of the story, and it brings me to our conclusion. Can you hear Jesus saying this to you right now? Perhaps you're not paralyzed like the man in the story, but perhaps there's an area in which you too are stuck or stalled or immobile. It's not religion that's going to save you. It's certainly not magic. There's no alternative medicine or spa treatment or whatever, recreational marijuana. that's going to give you the kind of life that you're looking for. It's only the voice of Jesus that can really get us moving again. So in this moment, right now, I want us to think quietly to ourselves. Jesus is standing in front of you and he's asking, do you want to get moving again? Do you want to walk in the fullness of the life that God has for you? Don't reply with a narrative of loss, of resentment, of missing out. Don't rely on the technicalities of religion. Listen to the voice of Jesus. And what Jesus is saying to you right now is pick up your mat and walk. In the quietness of this moment, this is what Jesus is saying to us. Get up and walk today.